Yeah, I love snorkeling around beaches here and around Rottnest and up north. Particularly love Ningaloo. I've been going there, well, I don't know, nearly 50 years on and off. But I see the changes, you know. You can see the loss of species. You can see the damage that's being done to the Great Saline Reef. So it gets more and more confronting, really, I'm afraid. Every year you go snorkeling and you know this is really in trouble. I'm Bill Hare. I'm now the Director of Climate Analytics, a think tank headquartered in Berlin, but with an office here in Perth. So I'm Fremantle. I'm originally a physicist and environmental scientist trained at Murdoch University. And I've worked in the environment and climate space since the 1980s, really. I guess I first became interested in climate change through academic studies, and to be honest, wasn't really convinced it was a big deal until I did some work for a conference in 1987, which was the first actual global climate conference. And there I was charged with looking at the projected impacts of climate change. And already then, the literature was showing really serious issues coming. And I became aware that actually a lot of our natural environment in Australia was pretty much on the front line. And that's what motivated me to pay a lot of attention to the issue. And I worked on that in Australia, and then I moved to assist with the negotiation of the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change. And then coming out of the Rio conference, we wanted to get targets for the initial reductions for the developed countries, and that didn't really work. In those days, President George Bush, if I can call him George Bush the First, blocked any agreement on targets. And but so then there was a big campaign on to get a protocol to the climate convention, and that became the Kyoto Protocol. And there was a race around the world diplomatically to pull that off. Finally, it was done in 1997, and I was very much involved with that. And then, of course, the Bush government, George Bush the Second, if I can put it that way, he rejected the Kyoto Protocol in March of 2001. And the Kyoto Protocol and, indeed, climate action was in trouble from that moment onwards. And we know now that, and for me at the front line, it was very clear at the time that it was the fossil fuel industry, really. It was absolutely obvious. And subsequently, one of the highlights of my career was being involved with the IPCC Fourth Assessment Report. Unknown to us IPCC authors at that moment, the Nobel Peace Committee was assessing who it would give the prize to, and all of the lead authors of the Fourth Assessment Report received a Nobel certificate with a Nobel Prize, which was a great honour, but all the other assessments, I think, would have equally deserved that kind of recognition. But that was quite a big thing, of course, to have our whole milieu of scientists working on this report, including us individually, to be acknowledged in that way. It was really a nice thing. Of course, during this period, Australia essentially disgraced itself by rejecting the Kyoto Protocol. And the climate wars, for my taste, as they call it in Australia, really began back then with John Howard, and they continue to this day, really. But during this period, I also, the mid-2000s were dominated very much by a campaign to keep climate action alive, actually, and culminated in the fairly catastrophic Copenhagen conference in 2009, where negotiations sort of fell apart. It was a gigantic mess, actually, and people were very sceptical as to whether or not we could actually get an agreement. So I think everyone who was in that process, it took some months to get over. But when we regrouped, and I was then very much involved with the Alliance for Small Island States and subsequently also with the Least Developed Country group to try and work out how to put climate action back on the agenda and get a global agreement, a successor, if you like, to the Kyoto Protocol. And the big thing for me in the last decade has been the getting of the Paris Agreement. That was a epic campaign. It was really groundbreaking. And is lying behind a lot of the global push now towards net zero. Net zero that everyone talks about stems from, like, I just say this, the physics of the Paris Agreement. If you are going to basically limit warming to 1.5 degrees, the limit in the Paris Agreement, then you've got to get to net zero. And the physics tells us as soon as you get to net zero CO2, you've got warming stopped, more or less. And in that context, we contributed, me and my organisation, contributed to helping the small island states and least developed countries get the agreement. We provided scientific and diplomatic support for that. We have quite a lot of really good scientists and also IPCC authors on board, and we have an excellent diplomatic team. My motivation for getting engaged with the small island states goes back to the 1980s and early 1990s, because visiting the Pacific and going to an atoll island is quite a confronting experience when you know what's coming. You know, it's when you go to a place like Tuvalu year after year, you can see what's happening. You don't need a satellite. You don't need a lot of measurements. You can see it, and it's very confronting. Erosion of the atolls happening. You see the seas affecting structures. You see places that were never flooded before, homes, houses, little roads and so on, flooded regularly that never were. You see cultural places, burial grounds and so on, exposed to the sea that never happened before. Crops that can't be grown anymore because of saltwater intrusion. You just hear of more problems like that. You can just see the gradual accumulation of damage. When you talk to people, you can hear about it. You can hear about the gradual changes in fish caused by warmer waters, migration of fish stocks that used to be prevalent, disappearing, the outbreak of coral bleaching. You can see, you can go in the water and see it. So yeah, these things all accumulate. I mean, one of the things that we knew about in the scientific space for a long time was the risk of marine heat waves. Yeah, and for a while they were hypothetical, but they have emerged with force on the west coast of Western Australia, from really the Kimberley right down to, you know, the Great Australian Bight. And we know they have really damaged our fisheries and our wildlife in the waters around Fremantle, and that's going to become a bigger and bigger issue for us, and it will affect our recreational amenities. It will affect the things that we come to love here, you know, what we see in the water, our enjoyment of the water and the seas and so on will be diminished by what's going on. In a healthy ocean, there's a lot of clicking and sometimes banging from fish, you know, biting bits of coral or weed and so on, or clicking of crustaceans, they click their claws or move around. So that's a very dominant sound. And if you don't hear it, then it's strange, actually. And increasingly, you can go into the sea here and not hear much. Whereas once upon a time, you know, if you went into the water, I don't know, anywhere around here, you'd hear clicking and scraping and so on. And I find you just don't hear that as much anymore. And we're also seeing the gradual encroachment of the seas on our coasts. And that comes up as an anecdote that some car park is undermined at Port Beach, or further up the coast a set of stairs is undermined and falls down. But the bigger pattern is that we're gradually losing our coast. And that shouldn't be a surprise either. It just shouldn't be. We knew this was coming, and we've done extraordinarily little about it. I just don't think that we've really got our heads around the threats to our marine environment and to our coasts that are coming. And it's very difficult to get anyone to even listen to it, actually. They get their nice little coastal engineering reports that use 20-year-old IPCC projections, and it all sounds pretty cool. Well, it's not cool. It's not going to be good. And it's going to be a really big problem if we don't work out just how we're going to manage what is an increasingly severe risk of very rapid sea level rise occurring within the coming decades. You know, and I think that's why there is so much anger out there now. And actually, also, I think it translates into disengagement by younger people. They see all these problems and they see nothing happening. It goes on and on as though there's no climate change problem. And I get a sense there's no real self-awareness in the political class of what they're doing. I think they are dismissive. They won't listen. They don't want to listen, and they are full of excuses. It's an extraordinary time that we're in now, and I understand therefore why people are throwing confetti at Wimbledon or doing other things in order to raise the alarm. Because if you look at the physics of what's happening to the planet now, we are just out of time. You know, 5 or 10 years ago, it was still like we can still move this, but now it's looking like a really, really big mess. And the extraordinary temperatures we've seen just in the last week, where the modern climate reanalysis system is telling us that we've seen the warmest days probably in the last 125,000 years. This month, this last month, over the planet, we're seeing record low sea ice, Arctic, Antarctic. We're seeing extraordinary heat waves across Asia. And we're heading into an El Nino year in Australia, which we know is hardly ever good. And the political class in Australia is just going on and on and on with the same thing, as though nothing has changed. And yet everything has changed. I mean, what we've seen in the last months is just nothing, nothing compared to what is going to happen in the next decade or so. What people need to do is to focus on their political representatives and to make sure that their political representatives know that they're concerned and know what they want done about it. They need to stop, you know, angsting about whether they've reduced emissions in their own houses. Many have. But it's the bigger system that needs to change. Of course we need to take care of our own lifestyles. Of course, but people have been doing that and it hasn't added up to hill of beans, basically. And meanwhile, emissions in this state have grown rapidly and will continue to grow. And unless and until the political system gets the message that it's not acceptable, we will see that continuing to happen. Scientists are by their nature fairly conservative, and what's happening is a radicalisation in the scientific community. People have kind of lost it, to put it in colloquial terms, just lost it. We do our models, we do our reports, no one's listening, no action is taken. The Biden administration opens up the Arctic Reserve for gas and oil, right? Or here, the Environment Minister approves another huge coal mine or another new gas field. It goes on and on. And scientists are just saying, it's just enough. We have to stop this. Otherwise, we're going to be toast, really. And we might be just fine sitting here in Fremantle, but hundreds of millions of people in more vulnerable parts of the world will not be just fine.